This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and for this special episode, I'm joined by coding educator Jesse Chartier. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Fraser. It's exciting to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to discussing this. You know, Bradley and I have just done an episode kind of covering the landscape, if you like, of Apple's Everyone Can Code program, and people will be familiar with what is available, but I thought it would be interesting to have a conversation between you and I about what the experience of teaching with that is like as well. I mentioned a little bit in the previous show, but we'll definitely dig into that as well. So first of all, can you give the audience a kind of introduction to who you are, what you do, and what your kind of background is in both teaching and coding?
Sure, I'd love to. So currently I'm focused on teaching teachers how to code and become more proficient in their profession as coding teachers. My background, just real quickly, I started as a high school English teacher. I grew kind of in my own way, started working more with curriculum development, helped other teachers get better at their profession, found my way into higher education, and then ultimately landed at Mobile Makers, which focused on training adults initially to become iOS developers in the space, which is a hard thing to do, but we did it, and we did it with grace and lots of virility. So what we started with in the adult training space was to help people do career changing. So they were looking at coming into the iOS field from other careers, whether it was musicians or bank accountants or what have you. And we would train them in 8 weeks to become iOS developers. And we got so good at it that local schools started to come knocking on our door, and local teachers said, "Hey, what you're doing out here is really authentic to the marketplace and serving the marketplace. So we want to bring those skills into our students." And so being a former high school teacher, I was able to help translate what we were doing in the adult iOS space to right size it for high school students. And so we really focused on supporting the teachers in their training. One of our big focus points is to really treat teachers as professionals. And so we focus a lot on how do we support them as professional educators. And that means how do we train them how to code. So it's been a great journey, and we're really looking forward to continuing to grow and continuing to reach more students.
Okay, so that period where you were training people who were doing a career change, what kind of time period was that? I'm just trying to sort of place it in terms of the development of the iOS market at that point.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we started initially as an apprentice program within a development shop, and that was in 2008, 2009. So when iOS first came out, very, very early. And then we opened our doors to the public and became a boot camp, so people could pay us to come through our training program in 2012. So we had a few years to refine our apprentice model, and then before we opened up the doors to the public. So then from 2012 to 2016, we focused on converting career changers, so getting them from wherever they were into iOS development. High school started in 2014, and it just has been going gangbusters ever since. So since then, we've really focused on the high school market, being able to teach the teachers, because we feel like we can give more opportunity to more people by reaching them through the teachers and the school systems.
Okay, that train-the-trainer model seems to be a very common model that a lot of, I suppose, both training agencies, but also, you know, schools and governments are trying to kind of scale up the transfer of knowledge that way, aren't they?
They are. I mean, at least in the States, we're having a real trouble trying to fill the need for these coding classes at the high school and elementary and middle school level. You know, most people who are proficient in computer science, who go through a degree program, if you will, get a bachelor in science or even master's, don't often return to the classroom. They will often return as coders or developers or computer scientists or data scientists in the marketplace, but they won't go back and teach. And so we have a lack of teachers who are qualified and knowledgeable enough in these systems and in these programming languages to even be able to teach them. So that's kind of one of the main reasons that our flagship program is a year-long program, really looking to help transition a teacher of any discipline into a coding teacher. So it's a lot of fun. And I mean, we have so much experience working with adults and transitioning them from wherever they were into iOS developers that it was a natural fit for us to take any teacher and teach them how to code. And having had experience with teaching coders how to teach at the bootcamp level and teaching teachers how to code, I can tell you it's a little bit more easier, I guess. I don't want to, I got to be careful with how I phrase this, but it is, it's a little bit easier to teach teachers how to code than it is to teach coders how to teach.
Yeah, I think that's certainly, that empathy is always there for a teacher, or should be there for a teacher, I suppose, but programmers, I mean, and that was kind of my path into education, was converting from being a computer science graduate into teacher, and sometimes, I was talking about this in a previous show recently, like clicking with people who don't know how to program is sometimes difficult, because I do, like I really do, and it's something I've been working on, you know, for years and years, trying to get down to everybody's level and understand what it takes to approach this in a kind of meaningful way and an authentic way as well. And I think that point about authenticity, I think, makes an interesting segue into the discussion of Swift as well. Because I'm guessing that given the time scales you've outlined, Jesse, you would have started with teaching Objective-C and Xcode tools.
We did. Our pilot teacher program that was going through training at the time, 2014, summer of 2014, we were about 4 days away from graduation, and WWDC came out, and we were all excited. We're all going to be Objective-C developers. Let's sit down and watch the keynote together. Yeah. And then our jaws hit the floor when they said, and we're releasing Swift. But being, we're all about trying to be cutting edge and trying to provide what really is going on in the marketplace to students. So we spent the next 30 to 40 days revising the curriculum and shifting from Objective-C to Swift and retraining the teachers, which, if you're outside the development world, sounds like it's an incredible task, and it was, but going from Objective-C to Swift was much easier than going from a totally different programming language to Objective-C. So it was doable, so we were able to make that happen, and so we were the first to market with training teachers in Swift, which was really exciting for us.
And that's kind of worked out into a big win, I suppose, in the subsequent years because of Apple's, you know, heavy, and I suppose to a certain extent, a sudden push into education and coding education with the Everyone Can Code program and so on. And of course, all of that is Swift. You know, Objective-C is simply nowhere in that whole discussion, as it is increasingly sort of nowhere in Apple's discussion of code at all, really. And I think, I don't know, were you surprised by Apple's push into that area, or did you have an impression that something might be happening there?
I was pleasantly surprised to see their interest and push into the education space a little bit more so than they have in the past. I love the fact that they're really interested in making sure that the teachers have the right tools in front of them, because I think that one of the hardest things that any educator has in front of them is not only being able to translate the content into something that is digestible for the students, to craft that perfect learning environment so students can learn, but is also to stay on top of the market, like what's going on, especially when it goes on with technology and with how quickly things are changing. So it's been really nice to see so many companies kind of rallying for that and being able to say, well, we'll help transition that. We'll help you figure out what's changed and what's not. And like, we are a perfect example of that. I mean, Swift in the early days was changing so often that having to make sure to keep our teachers up to date and knowing exactly where every teacher was. I mean, some of them didn't even have the ability to update Xcode or their computers. So we had some people that were working on the first iteration of Swift through the entire first year of their training. And so that was an interesting learning opportunity for us. But it definitely is really exciting to see Apple put some effort behind making sure that teachers have what they need in regards to content, because they can keep updating the curriculum. So as Swift starts to change, they can start to change certain things with it so that teachers always have the nearest stuff to them, which is great.
Yeah, you've kind of anticipated the next point I was going to make, or the next question, which was, you know, how was that experience of kind of riding the Swift train, if you like, in those early days when the language definitions were changing very quickly? And I know even my experience as a Swift teacher has kind of been since Everyone Can Code came out. We were teaching Python at the time, and we switched over to teaching Swift. And even as I'm still learning the language, the examples that I'm finding online are often deemed incompatible or needing a fix or needing an upgrade. And it's nice that the Swift app can do that. You know, Playgrounds can suggest upgrades and fixes for outdated code. But the language has changed dramatically in that time, hasn't it?
It has. It has. And the first year was very much building the plane in flight. And it was, I think that we were, one thing that we were very, very open about, and we we really leaned on heavily was the expertise of the teachers and being able to let them know that they were really first to market. You know, these were the early adopters who were hungry and interested in really being able to bring this to the schools. And so we were able to really collaborate with them. You know, our biggest strength was listening to what they needed and just adapting and making sure that they had what they needed in order to make their experience great for the students. So a lot of it was listening to what's going on in the market, but and then turning around and saying, hey, teachers, this is what's going on, but also really listening to what the teachers needed and being able to provide that in a really timely fashion, I think is one of the reasons that we were so successful and still are successful, is that we are very adaptive. I mean, we have to be, because the marketplace for technology changes so fast, but it doesn't for education. And so being able to create that bridge between something that's moving much faster is something that's critical for teachers to be able to be successful. So it was very much the building the plane in flight, but we had a great group of teachers early on in the pilot phase that were just rolling with the punches and brilliant in their ability to adapt and adjust and still meet the needs of the students and still get them to where they needed to be. So I have no complaints.
No, it's all good. I mean, I think one of the things from running an iPad program in school is one of the things I've noticed is that you can't kind of hold back the world in the way you used to. You know, you've referred there to teachers who weren't able to update Xcode or update their operating system on the computer. In an iOS world, you're very much kind of like the deployment's kind of moving on almost ahead of you sometimes. You know, new apps come out, they get pushed out, iOS comes out, people will press update straight away. You know, new content comes out. We were just saying this before we came on air, that a brand new challenge just came out in Swift Playgrounds about an hour ago. And by the time I get to school tomorrow, somebody's going to have completed that challenge already. I'm sure of that. So, you know, even just overnight, people can be ahead of you as well. So you're right. It's a very much a kind of moving carpet to work on, isn't it?
But I think it's also an indication of kind of how the field of education in technology, with the use of technology, is starting to shift a little bit. I mean, every time we train new teachers, we inevitably have at least one teacher ask, well, what happens when a student asks a question or gets ahead of me and I don't have an answer? And it's always great to see there are other teachers in the room that applaud that and they say, well, that means you're doing your job right. You know, there's always going to be a teacher that is, and a student, more importantly, there's always going to be a student in your class that is going to be ahead of you, that's going to be learning different things. Because in this field, especially with development in this field, it is impossible for one person to know everything. And so you become much more of a shepherd, much more of a facilitator than a sage on the stage when it comes to this content. And so how do you craft and architect a learning environment that encourages that and pushes students to learning to that nth degree and find their own ways? You know, that I think a lot of that has to happen because, like you mentioned, the technology is always going to be ahead of us. We will never be at the bleeding edge with the rest of them because it's too much. There's too many other things that are going on. Especially as a teacher. I mean, you have prom throws an entire week of your calendar off. So it's, you know, it's, you got to be able to adjust, and Christmas and all of those things too. Exactly. So it's necessary to learn to work in the ambiguity, but feel confident in your own abilities and your students' abilities. And I think that that's one of the reasons I really like teaching teachers how to code, because it is a natural environment that elicits that behavior and rewards that behavior of experimentation, of curiosity, of working in ambiguity, problem solving, critical thinking. It's just kind of this nice little package deal of all of the things that we really want everyone to have better skills at. And it's exciting to see that transformation at the teacher level as well as the student level.
I'm interested in, you mentioned earlier that you're teaching teachers of every discipline to come to programming and do you have a focus like on incorporating programming into their discipline, or are you more about making them able to teach a specific coding curriculum as such?
Well, right now it's more focusing on helping them teach coding curriculum, because that's really where the need in the schools are. You know, you have students clamoring for more coding classes. That's where we focus on filling the need. However, we have seen teachers start to integrate these things into their other disciplines. And most of the time, we're either teaching business teachers. Once occasionally, we'll get math or science teachers, but we'll have business teachers. And from our experience with the adult boot camp, It's not the traditional person that you would think would be successful in coding. Like, it's not necessarily the mathematician that does really well. It's the mm-hmm. artists, it's the musicians, the people that recognize and look for patterns and love problem solving and have that sense of perseverance. Those are the people that are really successful as coders and developers. Mm. It's very interesting to see. And for students, we've actually seen students who are strong athletes are also very good at coding because they have that sense of persistence where they just don't want to give mm-hmm. up. They want to figure it out. They want to solve it.
And that's very interesting. I think that there is an opportunity. It seems to be arising, and I'm not necessarily saying it's just because of everyone can code in Swift playgrounds, but I think there's an opportunity to bring a whole lot more people into programming. I know your experience is probably similar to mine, that there was a certain kind of person that would always click with programming and everybody else was left very cold by it. And I think what I've certainly seen in the time I've been teaching Swift is the Everyone Can Code curriculum has made it more accessible to a number of people. People who maybe are more visual in their approach, more spatial in their approach. That's one of the things that we were talking about with the Everyone Can Code curriculum, is that it's very spatially orientated. And I've noticed that people who, kids who have tested well in spatial reasoning in our school, are doing unbelievably well in Swift playgrounds because of the kind of puzzle based and map based nature of the programming that you do in that program.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I agree with you 110%. And I think what the Swift Playground app for the iPad does is it creates this beautiful bridge between block-based coding, which is where a lot of the students are starting to learn coding, mm-hmm. you know, in a variety of ways, and really the syntax coding. So it creates this really nice bridge between what they're familiar with and leading them into some more of that complicated thing. But the visual piece is really intriguing to me specifically, because I was never, I mean, this is the first time that I was involved in programming when I started at Mobile Makers. I mean, I had taken an HTML class years ago in college and then okay. was very proud of that until I learned that that was not really object-oriented design coding. And so now, but I'm much more proficient now. But one of the things that I found very interesting is the shift in how we approach teaching coding, and how we moved away, or at least the way that we do it, is we don't teach data movement first. We teach visuals first. We meet mm-hmm. the students where they are, which is their user. So let's talk about the interface builder. Let's talk about how you're interacting with this button. And now let me kind of lift the hood up and show you how that actually works underneath, so that you have context for when I talk about passing data, or when you're actually talking about a variable scoping and all these other things. They don't have context for that. But if you start with that visual piece, and you start with that, oh, I've got this grounded. Oh, yeah, I remember when the little bit character did this, this, and this. Now, all of a sudden, that those really complex, abstract movement of data becomes a little bit easier to manage and becomes contextual. So now you can understand why certain things are really useful, why loops are really exciting and functions are just really creative and a lot of fun. So I think that what Apple has done with that Swift Playgrounds for iPad has been just genius in regards to that bridging between block-based coding and syntax coding. And it sets the students up very much for success, especially in coding for Swift, because we've seen students just chew through those apps and are ready for Xcode by the time they even get to eighth grade. So it's really exciting to see how it's opened up. And one of the nice things about what coding has really allowed is for us to be able to see people solving problems that we didn't even know existed. You know, these are people that may not have had an opportunity to really learn coding, and all of a sudden they're going off and building solutions. They're building apps for things that they have problems with, and it's great. It's great to see. I mean, my favorite examples is we had a student who went through a course that was taught by one of the teachers that came through our program, and he got so frustrated that the cast list for the theater department was being posted in the lunchroom. He's like, how demoralizing. And we all thought, well, that's how we did it. And the moment I thought that, I'm like, oh, something's wrong with that. It's like, well, that's what we did. Why is that such a problem? That's always a bad sign, right? So he got frustrated with that and said, well, forget this. I'm going to build an app. And so he did. He built an app that had a director login and had a student login, and the entire casting system was done through the app. So the director was able to take notes, was able to do callbacks, was able to schedule everything You got a push notification if you were cast. You got push notifications for something else. So everything was, he took that process of casting and he eliminated the problem that, of course, that teenagers would be frustrated with. Who wants to stand in front of everybody and their brother and see whether or not you actually got a part, and create a solution for it, you know? And I think that that is what's really exciting about all of this coding stuff, is that we're empowering people to do some really amazing things and to solve problems that are right in front of them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I took my kids to the university that I went to recently, and I showed them the place where you used to have to go and get your exam results on a piece of paper. They would post it up on the wall, and I said, you know, we used to stand here and look at our exam results, and, you know, if you passed, it was great, and if you hadn't, it was terrible, because everybody knew everybody else's exam results. But data protection laws killed that eventually, so they have to send it out now. But that's a similar kind of idea there. So I suppose the next kind of thing I'm interested in is these new approaches you're talking about to programming. You know, we're just looking at some notes here. You have some really interesting one-liners in here that I kind of want to tease out. What are you talking about here? Because it's not the way I would think about programming, but of course the way I think about programming is by no means the correct way or the only way. And I'm very interested in, you've written here, poetry analogy.
Oh, yeah, I love this analogy.
I'd like to know what you're talking about there.
We often talk with a lot of administrators or teachers that haven't had coding experience, right? That's our whole flagship program. And so we try to explain how we approach coding. And many times we get asked why Swift. You know, we created a program well before we were an Apple provider. And now that we are, we get the question a lot of, well, have you always taught Swift? And we had the choice of whether or not we wanted to go with an Apple programming language or not, you know, especially with schools in the States. So many of them are Google focused, they're Chromebooks or their Surfaces or something else. And so the way that we explain why we went with Swift is through this poetry analogy. And it is one of my favorite analogies, because I think it really kind of focuses in on what programming can do, that connection between creativity, but it also explains why Swift is the language we chose. So when we first, the way that we approach it is that when you're first teaching someone to code for the very first time, it's very similar to teaching someone poetry. And you don't teach someone poetry by handing them free verse at the very beginning. You don't hand them free verse and say, this is poetry, let's go over exactly how. There's too many variables. There's too many, you know, changes to the rules. And very specifically, there's reasons people change the rules in free verse, et cetera. And so when you start by teaching poetry, you start with something that is very structured, something that's very predictable. So something that has the constraints and the structure so that people can really focus in on the fundamentals of poetry, rhyme, rhythm, cadence, all that good jazz. So you start with a sonnet. You start with something that's very contained. And then as they get proficient in that, and as they grow with their figurative language and all these other things, then you can expand out into other forms of poetry and ultimately free verse. So when you're teaching coding, you want to keep it as structured and constrained as possible so that what they're learning is the actual programming language, that they're learning the fundamentals of computational thinking. So we went with Swift because of the ecosystem that is around Swift. It's very contained. It's very structured. And even the language itself is very clean in regards to how close it is to the English language. And so because of that, we went with Swift. Now, that's not to say that students can't go out and study something else. Like Python would be a great opportunity for them to kind of transition what they learned. But we start with Swift because we wanted to be able to have it very accessible. We had a list of criteria. So we wanted it to be really accessible. We wanted it to be really easy to use. We didn't want to have a poor teacher be stuck for 2 weeks downloading, you know, the actual software to try and code or have disparate versions of it. We just wanted it to all be very, very streamlined. But we also wanted a language that was really robust, because you know that we have students out there that are incredibly far ahead in regards to their computational thought, and we didn't want to hold them back. And so we needed a language that was also really, really hefty and really robust and could handle a lot of stuff. So that Swift just met all of the criteria that we wanted to meet, so that's why we went with it. But that goes back to the poetry analogy. Like, it's all about starting with something that is structured and constrained in order to properly let people focus on what they need to be focusing on so that they can expand themselves as they grow forward.
That's absolutely fascinating, because when I was at WWDC for the launch of Swift Playgrounds, we had a session with some of the people from the team and the teachers who were on the scholarship program. And one of the questions I had in that session was that I sort of challenged them. They were kind of using a line in those days where they were saying kind of like, well, apps are written in Swift. Kids love apps. Therefore, by the transitive property, kids are going to love Swift. And I was kind of like, well, you've got to give me a better reason than that, you know. And from a computer science point of view, I was like, well, tell me some language features that are good for education and things like that. And we eventually kind of had a discussion where we started talking about, well, the advantage of strong typing in Swift and all of these things and consistent syntax. And it's fascinating to hear you kind of come to the exact same conclusion from a totally opposite direction, that the Swift language is a very powerful one for teaching, but also one of the big goals of Swift is, from a design point of view, is to be able to go from simple scripts, simple programs, all the way up to, you know, full production code, operating systems, things like that. So that's a fascinating analogy, and one that I'll probably steal from time to time from now on, if that's okay.
By all means.
Thank you. So yeah, that's an interesting way to come at it. And the other question, or kind of area for exploration, is the idea of sort of contextual experience and where students are coming from, what are they bringing to the classroom. You mentioned there that you had some students who were, or your students had students who were, you know, very far ahead in computational thinking and so on. Where are those people coming from?
It depends. Well, the students come from a variety of areas, and I'm always surprised at where the computational strengths are. Students who have any experience in the real world, whether they have a job or whatnot, are almost always ahead in certain areas, especially when it comes to some of those harder concepts like delegation and custom classes and all that stuff, because they have real world context to be able to connect the language to. I think that that's one of the harder things about programming languages in general, especially as a native English speaker, is that I feel like I should understand what's going on. But when I read it, if I don't understand what a variable is, there's this sense of, oh man, I'm an English speaker, but I don't understand what this means. I must be stupid. So I think that there's like this initial barrier. But the students who do really, really well with it are the students who are the ones who really like to problem solve, the ones who are really good at picking away at a puzzle and being able to find what's really underneath everything. And we talk about contextualizing the experience, or I like to call it touching the abstract, where if you don't have any of programming experience, it's really, really, really tough to understand how things move in the background. So something as simple as when you have to multiply two numbers together, like knowing that that's data getting passed from something to something else, even the word passing the data is like, I have no idea what that means if you've never touched the code before. But one of the things that we try to do is really kind of help them understand of you are a user, because going back to what you mentioned, so many of these students are using apps every day, even if it's just in the classroom, even if they don't have a mobile device of their own, they're using web apps all the time. So the idea of a hyperlink or a button is very, very, very familiar to them. So if you start with where they are and help them contextualize and see, oh, see what you just did there as a user? That's moving something behind the scenes. Let's look at that. It becomes much easier for them to understand some of those deeper concepts. And so our students who've been really successful are kind of similar to the same that we've seen with the adults be successful. They're athletes, they're musicians, they're the creative arts. They are the people who are interested in being problem solvers. Organizational charts are sometimes the favorite things of some of these people to build. Not spreadsheets, but just being able to see how movement of things happen. So I don't know if that's answering your question or not, but that's kind of what we see, is really helping people contextualize their experience and being able to kind of see and think about how things are going on underneath the hood of all the code.
Yeah, it was interesting because when... not so long ago, back in December, I had to present our experience of teaching with Playgrounds at an Apple event in London. And the way I approached that was I actually asked my classes to whom I was teaching Swift. I said, you know, tell me your experience and, you know, tell me what you think of this program. Tell me what you think of the lessons. Tell me what you think of the tools you've got at your disposal. And one of the interesting themes that came out of that was a number of students said I now much more appreciate the people who write the apps that I use every day, because now I get how complicated it is. And that was something that I was really pleased with. You know, not that they were overwhelmed by complexity as such, but just that they finally had an appreciation for the complexity of real world programming. Because that's something, I don't know if you have noticed this or your students, but whenever people come to a coding class, they're always the expectations are so high for what they're going to achieve very quickly. And I've often struggled with, you know, people's sense of disappointment that they were not able to build Minecraft within a fortnight or whatever. And so giving people a kind of easy way into like real complexity has been very interesting to watch people's expectations and understanding change, and a little bit of humility in the face of what can sometimes be, you know, very complex problems to solve has been very interesting to see that develop a little bit more.
We've seen that too on our end. I mean, we have it both from the teacher and the student side. We have students who have gone through our program and then gone on through a sister program we have that focuses on entrepreneurship, who have walked in and they've been very clear about what they can and cannot do as a developer. And it has actually made some business models in that entrepreneurship class stronger, because they understand the complexity of the app that they're that they think they want to build. And then they're like, oh, this is way too complex. We have to figure out something else. But we've also seen it at the teacher end, where all of a sudden a course will, or the school will offer an iOS class, and the teacher gets bombarded with questions and demands, or requests, I should say, from other teachers. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, we need an app that does blah, 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 blah. Can your students do that? Yeah. And you're like, we are in week two. They're just learning what a variable is. Like, we can't build Facebook for the school. You know, it's...
Yeah, I've got an idea for an app problem is a consistent one, isn't it?
Yeah, yes it is. But I think it's also really awesome that there are so many great opportunities out there, like the Learn to Code and a variety of these other things that help people really see the complexity behind it, like what you were talking about. I mean, it's very similar to how we have to take driver's ed here, where we have to understand how the mechanics of our car works. That doesn't mean we're all going to go off and be car mechanics, but we all have to understand the fundamentals of the machines that we're using, what they're like, how they're functioning, so that we can be better users of those machines. And I feel like coding takes it one step farther, and it's not only just a yes, we can be better users and better appreciation of, et cetera, but it also gives us almost like an inside scoop into becoming our own problem solvers. You know, I'm not going to go off and make a new form of transportation just because I know how my car works, but I theoretically could come up with a better business solution because I understand how coding works.
I guess one of my kind of next questions or expand on this a little bit, like, where does computational thinking fit in with actual hands-on coding practice?
Oh, that's a great question.
One of the ways that we bring that in is we actually use a course called Pixar in a Box, which is run by Khan Academy. We use that for kids who are 11 and 12 years old, and then they go in from there into hopscotch programming, and then from there into Swift Playgrounds. And that's a very interesting and very contextually relevant way for young children to start to think about the complexity behind something like making a Pixar movie. But I'm interested in your experience as well of the relationship between computational thinking as a mental discipline and then hands-on coding as well.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think we're at a really interesting evolution point in regards to how coding and computer science is seen in schools. And I think that it's going to continue to evolve. But what I see is, in regards to computational thinking, I think the computational thinking is going to become earlier and earlier and stronger within our disciplines of school and within the students that we teach. It's the coding piece that is going to, I almost want to say, not necessarily stagnate, but I think that it's going to become separate eventually from the computational thought. And this is the reason that I say that. I feel like computer science is growing, and it's almost stratifying in the field, where very much like it was early medicine, where when you went to medical school very, very, very early on, you were an expert of all things medicine, cradle to grave. There was no specialty. Like, you knew everything there was to know about the human body, theoretically. And then as our understanding of the human body and medicine continued to grow, our sophistication within the medical field grew as well. And so we began to stratify the medical field so that you had specialists, and then you also had both not only specialists at one level, but you also stratified the other way, where you could have resident nurses all the way up through subspecialists for pediatrics. So I feel like computer science is kind of moving in that same direction, where computer science is so broad of a term, but what you can do with it is specialized. So you can do data scientists, you can become a developer, you can be a coder, you can be a software engineer, you can do all of these really complex things, but you could also do all of these other things that are available to people who are interested in coding and computer science. So I think that what will ultimately happen is that the computational thought will become almost like a continual thread throughout all of education, very much like problem solving, where it will become something that is explicitly stated and looked at and measured across all of the disciplines, across all of the years, and that the ability to code and program will just facilitate those things in those specific disciplines, very much like what reading and writing did. We do read and write in order to better our understanding of science. I think that we're going to use programming to, as a similar way, to be able to manipulate data and move information around in order to better understand our disciplines. So I don't think it's going to be this its own field. Yeah, it will always be its own field, but I don't think it will be so isolated in the school system that I think it will be much more integrated into almost a literacy of a sort throughout all of the courses.
Yeah, it's almost like you could imagine that, you know, writing a computer program is just one expression of computational thinking that is there to solve a bigger problem of some kind. Because yes. I was having this conversation recently where we were talking, I had been presented with a problem, which was that in our primary one classroom, our kindergarten, we're getting these live eggs. And these are eggs with chickens inside that you keep in your classroom and they eventually hatch, right? So I was given the job by the primary one teacher to rig up a system whereby we could live stream these eggs over the internet to children's homes in the evening so they could see when the chicks hatch. And then we also had to be able to save the video so we could capture the moment when they pop out and all this kind of stuff in case it happened overnight. And I thought for a minute, I thought, that seems like a really hard problem. And then I Googled and I tweeted about it. And within, you know, 30 minutes of thinking about it, I had a complete solution. I just thought, nothing's actually really hard anymore, is it? You know, everything's just kind of there. And the skill, in fact, is just finding the bits, evaluating the bits, and then plugging the bits together in the right way. And that even scales up to things like, you know, if you imagine you have things like, you know, Amazon Web Services, you've got machine learning and image analysis and things like that. And you can even see, you know, bringing those tools in as part, kind of the way that in mathematics, you know, higher mathematics and so on, you would use something like Mathematica or MATLAB as one expression of the mathematics. You would pull in that part of computational thinking. And I'm just sort of sitting here surrounded by a couple of drones and robots and things that I got today to expand the Swift programming that we're doing, and thinking, you know, you could take this drone, you could plug that together with its camera, download pictures, analyze them, put them through a machine learning algorithm in the cloud, and there's all these pieces that you can pull together. And that computational thinking is really, for me, that's the bit that connects all of these dots, regardless of what exact problem you're trying to solve.
And I feel like that is, you hit on a really interesting point that is, I think, often overlooked, is that there's a difference between computational thinking and computer science. Like, computational thinking does not have to incorporate technology. It doesn't have to incorporate programming. It's that the computational thinking is, how do you leverage the resources around you to get a solution that you need? And that isn't always technology-based. It doesn't always have to be that way. But it is a new skill set that is something that is so vitally important. And maybe it's not even a new skill set, but I feel like it's definitely more emphasized now than it ever has been. I mean, when I was going through school, this is, you know, 1906 or whatever. I mean, I'm not that old, but when the dinosaurs were still around. But there was that sense that you had to have the solution within yourself. Like, you had to be able to know it. You had to be able to recall it, as opposed to you had to be able to assemble the solution. And I feel like that the ability to create that computational solution is so much more needed now because of the vast amount of resources that are out there. And I think that you hit on something straight on, which is, you know, how can you, can, do you have the capability of being able to look at all the resources in front of you, figure out which ones are best used to get the results you need? And if there aren't the right resources, which ones are you missing, and can you even get them? So I agree with you. I think that it's going to be much more ubiquitous across the board.
And I think that there's also a kind of aspect where there are other disciplines in the school that need to have an input into that as well.
Yes.
You know, like evaluation of sources and things like that. I mean, who knows about evaluation? It's, you know, the history teacher, for example. And how does that body of knowledge, the librarian, what do they know? How does that all play together? You know, you can almost imagine being like a component librarian for computational resources in the school. You know, we use Amazon Web Services a lot in our school for various bits and pieces, and we could, you could see, you know, a day when people are saying, well, I need computational power for this problem, or I need storage for this problem, or I need scheduling components for this problem, and who knows, and I need a database, I need machine learning, I need image analysis, I need, you know, categorization or whatever. And all these components are just there, and the opportunity to bring them to bear on your particular problem is fascinating. I mean, the day doesn't seem that far away when people will be doing image analysis on, you know, biological specimens through their tablet, through their smartphone, right in the classroom.
It's very Star Trek-y, and I love it.
It is. It's going to be great when it all comes together. So I wanted to ask you just about one other thing just before we kind of finish up here, Jesse, if that's okay.
Sure.
And the question is about after doing teaching coding outside of the normal scheduled curriculum, because you started off this whole thing by addressing the issue of there simply aren't enough qualified teachers to satisfy the demand for learning how to program. And one of the ways that a lot of schools, and I'm sure some of the teachers that you're teaching are attacking that problem, is by after school clubs and coding clubs and Hour of Code and things like that. And that's not something I have a lot of experience of, because I'm in the fortunate position of having scheduled classes for computer science. But I don't know if you could maybe speak to that for a little bit and just maybe talk about, you know, how people listening to this could get started with these kind of approaches, or what is the experience like? How do these things typically run? And, you know, if there are any issues to avoid or be careful about as you go through it.
Yeah, sure. So we've seen several schools that have done different types of coding clubs before, depending on the student population. So usually what we've seen work really well with after school coding clubs is to, regardless of whatever you're going to teach, let's say you're going to do learning to code 1 or learning to code 2 in the middle school. What we've seen work really well is to try and gamify it, because they're not meeting every day or even every other day. If it's only once a week, that's one thing that is really tough to do, is the atrophy with learning to code can be so high initially. If you aren't coding every day, it's like playing a musical instrument or being an athlete. If you aren't practicing frequently, you will atrophy very, very quickly. So the gamification of it as much as possible is going to allow you to have those students buy in, being able to have them invest the time outside of the coding club in order to continue to move forward. So that's one piece. The other piece that I really encourage is to go to different clubs and different athletic groups and pitch the coding club idea. Because if you don't, you're going to get your traditional coding club student in those coding clubs. And that's not necessarily bad, but one of the things that we are really interested in, and I think that is the field is interested in, is getting a variety of voices in the field to be able to use these tools and these resources that are out there. And so by going and pitching the idea to the girls' volleyball team or to a different type of club, gives exposure to people that may not even know that this particular avenue exists, that this is something that's even accessible to them. Because I think there's still a lot of stigma around programming and what coding is that it's for a very specific type of person. And that's not the case. It's for everybody. And so being able to try and draw those in will not only help increase the numbers of the class itself, but will also really help you diversify the students that are in your coding club, which just makes it that much richer and that much more enjoyable. It becomes a really great community when you've got a lot of diversity going on. So those are the two biggest things that I would recommend for anyone that's interested in doing an after-school club, is to try and gamify it as much as possible so that you can lower the amount of atrophy that happens in between the meetings, and then to talk with a variety of groups to try and increase your diversity in the club itself. Then you'll start to garner interest, and that usually is enough if you wanted to actually become a coding teacher to get the parents involved to say, hey, we really want a coding class in the school, so that you can start to make the case for having coding in the actual classroom.
Hey, those are all great ideas. Yeah, some of those I hadn't thought about, like promoting it inside other clubs. I think that's because then you have an opportunity to meet people who are willing to put in additional time outside of school to something, and then you may increase your opportunity there as well. So that's a great idea that I'd never thought of. So thank you for that. That's great.
You're welcome.
So anything else we should talk about? Is there anything I've missed in thinking about this?
I think we covered it all. We covered quite a bit today.
We did, yeah. And I think that'll be another level of thinking for people to get their teeth into. I mean, Bradley and I have talked a lot about the materials that are available, but I hope one of the things that I kind of hoped with this episode is that it would open people's eyes who maybe listen to the show but are not necessarily programming teachers, or maybe even don't want to become programming teachers, but can see some application for computer capabilities in their subject as well. And so if you're an art teacher, if you're a historian, if you're an English teacher, whatever, are there opportunities there? And to make people aware that it is possible to learn these things without, you know, excessive amounts of effort as well. So it's that's hopefully something that people have opened their eyes to as well.
I hope so too. I always, we run into the joy of explaining what we do to a lot of different stakeholders. And mm-hmm. the moment we use the word coding, they get concerned. So I can explain everything that we do. And, oh, we teach teachers how to code. Sometimes I've had people come back and say, oh, I have no idea what that means. So it's like, well, I'm teaching people how to actually bake bagels. So therefore, you can actually teach them how to bake bagels with your students.
There you go. So, Jesse, thank you so much for coming on. Tell listeners where they can kind of hear more about your work and you online.
Yeah, absolutely. So they can follow me on Twitter. I'm Jesse Chartier. That's all I am on Twitter. So you can follow me on Twitter. You could find out more about our flagship program, so Teaching Teachers How to Code, at mobilemakers.co. And I'm always available if you have any questions. Just give me a holler on Twitter and I'll respond to you right away.
Excellent. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Hope to have you back sometime in the future.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Fraser. This was great. Let's do it again.
So that wraps up our show for this week. Bradley will be back again next week. And in between times, you can catch Bradley and I on Twitter as well. I'm Fraser Spears. Bradley is Bradley Chambers. And we'd love to hear from you at any time online. See you next week.